I have to be less than my usual amount of generosity with interruptions if we have a time constraint, but of course I'll be here until at least the middle of Wednesday. So this is work in this paper with Chamberlain and Brian and Myers, and hopefully I'll get to the end and you'll understand what catastrophic means. It's not anything bad. It's all good. So the outline is as follows. So I apologize to people who are experts on the first part. Well, they're probably experts on all of the bits, but certainly the first part I'd like to remind you about is the whole setup with the Witten Hawking Page discussion. So if that gets a bit tedious, I apologize. I'll just remind you how it works. And then we'll... from here we'll start to the new stuff and hopefully get to the end. So the moral of the story is that there will be some fascinating structures from the general theory of phase transitions, which are called by the mathematicians catastrophe theory, and that's what the title is about. So the introduction and motivation are somewhat standard remarks now for us, for this audience. I'll say them very quickly. We have the effective theory of large N gauge theory, at least in these examples that have been studied very recently. It's really, as Tooth anticipated many years ago, there is an effective string theory, and the excitement is that it's actually the string theories that we know and love on ADS space across a possibly a another space. I'm just trying to skip unnecessarily trivial transparencies for you. Okay, so here we go. So we have, for example, large N equals 4 equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory being related to type 2b supergravity on ADS 5 plus S5, and then the 1 over N corrections have a very sensible organization type in terms of the full string theory, perturbation theory, and this ADS-CFC correspondence is a nice example of holography. I see from the audience that perhaps I shouldn't say any more about that and go straight on to the meat. Sorry. Yes? Okay, I just don't like to bring coals to Newcastle. Okay, let me say it a little bit more slowly. I apologize. 3 o'clock seems pressing. Okay, let me slow down a little bit. So, of course, for consistency to get the whole story to work out, the radius of the S5 and the inverse cosmological constant of the ADS5 are set by some of the stringy parameters, this combination in this particular example, and keeping the radii finite, as we stand alpha prime to zero, so we actually take the low energy truncations of string theory and goes to infinity, actually gives us a nice regime in which we can calculate. And so we're in large, we're in non-perturbative Pfaff coupling, but we're in very nice, power effective theory is very nice, classical, semi-classical theory of gravity. And of course, part of the motivation for studying this stuff is that it's a beautiful example of holography, which has been anticipated years ago by Tooth. So, of course, there are other versions of the conjecture for other spaces. For example, the ADS 4 version, which relates to D equals 11 supergravity, and its completion into M theory, or whatever your favorite name for it is. And there are similar conjectures and calculations for other spaces, including spaces which are not necessarily globally ADS, but locally, for example, Tab-Nut, Tab-Bulb ADS, reported on by my colleague here earlier this year. Yes? An easy way, strictly only for the abelian case can you literally do the duality and see it, and there are nice arguments due to Seiberg which motivate using R symmetry arguments which motivate the field from the field theory side of view.
Yeah.
But I think strictly only for n equals 1, if you like, can you honestly show explicitly that the extra scalar can be exchanged for a gauge field.
Seiberg
has arguments, and they're quite convincing. And of course, matrix theory requires it to get type 2B string theory to work out properly when you put it on the torus. Seti and Sustin had their own version of it. Basically, the SO8 is, of course, the light cone, the Lorentz symmetry, which is needed there, so that's another way to see it. But, yeah, there's no direct way for arbitrary n. Okay. Maybe I'm bringing a different type of call to your class. Okay. So here we go then. So the content of the correspondence comes when you actually try and do computations. And of course, Witten supplied us with a nice dictionary. And so part of such a statement, talking about specifying point-like operators, comes from actually identifying the conformal field theory partition function on M, which is the manifold upon which you have a conformal field theory, with some supergravity partition function on some bulk manifold E. And just for completeness, I put a sum of all possible Bs that could have M as a boundary. And if we were to evaluate the full partition sum, we should, of course, sum over all those possibilities. And so, not to my knowledge, just the ones that satisfy the original conjectures of the smoothness and everything. It's a good supergravity background to use without having to worry about the corrections, the upper prime corrections which we've been switching on. But presumably, as soon as you open up the possibility to do the full quantum corrections in the gravity and the one over corrections in the gauge theory, then presumably you can allow other things. Okay. So then at large n phase transitions then come precisely from that possibility of doing those sums, because in actually evaluating the supergravity partition function, I let's just focus on where we look at solutions which localize on some nice large supergravity, large action solutions. We can have, for example, the possibility that as we vary some parameter in the field theory's geometry, for example, the manifold M, as I call it, the field theory stops being dominated by contributions from, say, one manifold Vi and goes to some other manifold, which allows us the possibility of having phase transitions. And of course, this all depends on the fact that for large n, the action has a large factor of n, n squared in our case, a large power of n, positive power of n sitting there. That allows us at large n to have the possibility of these phase transitions, which of course you wouldn't expect. For example, if I were in finite volume, which we will be for most of this talk, you wouldn't expect such phase transitions to actually make sense, any thermodynamic sense, as we'll talk about, simply because we will be in finite volume. But because n is large, we still have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, and so thermodynamic sense of a phase transition can still be made sensible. So what we'll do is we will set up a whole Euclidean discussion, discuss the theory of finite temperature. The parameter in M which we will vary will be a circle which will be an inverse temperature, which will vary, and watch things happen. And then later on, we will also vary a charge. So we'll have a two-component phase diagram, and then things will become interesting.
So let's, before we do that, just remind ourselves of what Witten did immediately having made the observations I just pointed out. So he basically resurrected some nice work by Hawking and Page on the thermodynamics of ADF black holes. So, for example, the case of Euclidean ADS 5, which has a boundary S3 cross S1. So what we're going to do, this S1 is going to be our inverse temperature, it's going to be our Euclidean time, and so we will have this E is 1 over beta, and beta is the period of that circle. Okay, so there are two choices for, so this really is all Hawking and Page generalized to arbitrary dimensions. I'm going to set this up in ADS 5 so we can compare to it later on. So we have Euclidean ADS 5 itself as something that has M, which is X3 cross S1 as a boundary, and Euclidean ADS 5 has R4 cross S1 as its topology, so you can see that that's indeed something that has that boundary. Also, ADS 5 Schwarzschild has that has that topology as its boundary as well. So what we might be able to do is evaluate the action of these two solutions and see when one is favored over the other. And following the argument we made on the previous transparency, we should be able to see some interesting phase structure, perhaps, as a function of temperature. Of course, it's not guaranteed. It may be that the action of one is always the one which is favored, but we'll see. As Hawking and Page did, but that is not the case. So let me review this for you, such that we can move a little bit more quickly when we get a little bit more complicated. So, our solution to Einstein's equation, here is a matrix in the obvious coordinate, and omega 3 is the round S3 matrix, and I think everything else is clear. So tau is the coordinate on our circle. And so delta tau equals beta will be the period. So for ADS 5, because there are no zeros of the Killing vector associated with moving in that circle, the period is essentially arbitrary, and hence ADS can exist at any temperature in the given Hawking calculus. However, because there are horizons, for the Schwarzschild case, we have to actually make sure that we have a consistent choice for our temperatures, and that's of course where the interesting stuff comes in. So how do we do that? Well, we check for the existence of a horizon, and of course is that the larger root of, yeah?
I'm sorry, are you in the four dimensional case or the five dimensional?
Five.
And it shouldn't that be M of R squared?
Oh, yes. Gosh. Yes, that's an error. That's M of R squared. Thank you. This was originally a four-dimensional discussion, which I converted at the last minute and didn't get all the powers converted. I had a plane to catch in about an hour. So indeed, this requires an R squared.
So there's a horizon at the larger root of that equation, which I call R plus. And, of course, then what we want to do is make sure that when tau and R try and make an R2, leaving the S3 topology horizon, we have to make sure that it really is an R2 and that there aren't any conical singularities. And so we remove them by making sure that our circles, as we go to R plus, we make sure that our circles actually really are circles that we like, i.e. the circumference of a radius is really 2 pi. And so that's with that condition there, that is infinitesimally. And so it gives you a condition that the period of beta times b prime evaluated at r plus is equal to 4 pi.
And so when you do that, you get an equation for beta, which I think I have correct, for the right dimension.
Okay, so there it is. And notice, first of all, and we'll see some sketches of this later on, beta has a maximum at some specific value of R plus, and so that translates into a minimum temperature below which ADS Schwarzschild does not fit we can't define a temperature for it. Okay. Above that radius, there is, and so above that temperature, there are two allowed masses of black hole, simply because beta goes, you can solve for every temperature that is your quadratic at R, so you can solve for two radii and hence two masses. And there are two allowed masses of black hole, and we'll talk about the differences in a minute. So you can go and compute the action of this ADS Schwarzschild background, and I'll sketch out the details for that later, and there it is. And then from that, you can continue to define thermodynamic quantities and check that you're actually doing things consistently. So first of all, evaluate the expected energy, and that turns out to be the mass, whereas the normalized of the black hole, and the entropy of these turns out to be the area over 4g. So far we've done everything correctly with the Gibbons-Hawking calculus because it's giving us the things we expect from doing semi-classical fields on a curved background. Okay. So the phase structure then comes out as follows. For large beta, we're at low temperature, and the physics is dominated by the 88-5 geometry. It can't help but be because the Schwarzschild black hole cannot exist in that regime. And then above that temperature, as I mentioned before, there are two masses of black hole, M1 and M2, which are allowed. M1, the smaller, has negative specific heat and is unstable, and it has positive free energy. And I'm measuring free energy relative to ADS. So for negative free energy relative to ADS, something would be favored. M2, the larger, has positive specific heat, so it's thermally stable. But it has positive free energy below some temperature. I'll give a little diagram in a minute. But negative free energy above that temperature, which I call T-crypt. And of course, this is where the transition temperature really is, not at T-min. So we have a phase diagram which looks roughly like this. We have from zero temperature up to T-crypt, we have ADS dominates the thermodynamic ensemble, and then above that temperature, Schwarzschild ADS dominates. T-min is somewhere in this red region for ADS, but the free energies of the black holes are all positive, so they aren't chosen by the thermodynamic ensemble. So there's the phase diagram. And what we shall do, part of the goal of this paper is to show that when you put an extra dimension on the phase diagram, get some really nice physics.
About, you said there are no black holes below T-min.
Right.
You have to be in the right down to do things.
Yes, you can, but it has quantum singularities and wouldn't fit into the Gibbons-Hawking calculus.
Why can't I make the circle small enough to connect those things?
The size of the circle is not the issue. There's a conical singularity. So somewhere you're going to find that you'll find the tip of the cone, which is that.
All I'm saying is that if you look at the Lorentzian solution,
yeah.
Very small black holes have a high temperature. Very large black holes have a high temperature because they're an ADS.
Yeah.
You just look at all possible Schwarzschild ADS metrics, the temperature never goes below a certain amount.
Okay. And then the observation which Witten also made was that when you convert the free energy and entropy associated with the high temperature phase dominated by black holes, when you convert them using the ADS-CFT correspondence into field theory quantities, they really have field theoretic behavior, which is nice, and is another nice example of how ADS changes things to make relevance to conformal field theory actually true. I didn't say Ed Hirst did this. I said in Ed's paper, which I'm reviewing, he did this. And it was first pointed out by Gutzer Klebanov and Pete, and I apologize.
I didn't
And in the case of Vice, Schrödinger, and goodness knows how many other people. okay, yeah, that's fair point. Okay, so actually, for this audience, I'm not even going to make my usual remarks about unitarity of gravity and all that sort of business. I will go straight on to discussing the addition of charge in the whole setup. So a natural question then is, of course, is, well, so we've done Schwarzschild, what about charged black holes? And so, you know, let's study the Riesz and Norstrom black hole solution. And of course, you have to be careful. First of all, it's not a solution of pure Einstein, it's a solution of Einstein-Maxwell. And in this context, you need to actually make sure that Einstein-Maxwell is a consistent truncation of the full-gauge supergravity setup. It may not be. As a matter of fact, if you look at the full-gauge supergravity setup, it's not at all obvious that Einstein-Maxwell is a truncation. And by Einstein-Maxwell, I mean an F-squared term in the Lagrangian with no powers of the dilaton, no exponentiated powers of the dilaton in front of that F-squared term. It's easy to get a random power of the dilaton, but to actually throw that away completely and have Einstein-Maxwell is non-trivial. And so, and then the other question is, then is all of this relevant to the ADS-TFC correspondence? Let's look at the properties of these black holes and see whether they do what we think they should do. So, at the end of the day, the answer is that you can get an Einstein-Maxwell truncation of gauge supergravity in this setup by actually taking the spheres that I discussed before and putting rotations in them in a very symmetric way. So for example, for F5, which lives inside an R6, I have three planes in which I can put a rotation. And if I put equal amounts of rotation in those three orthogonal planes, I will actually get a beautiful truncation to pure Einstein-Maxwell. You can also do that for F7 and F3 and the relevant ADS stories for those guys. You can't do that for S4 because you don't have an even number of planes. You don't have a number of even planes you can do that with. You'll have a direction left over. So you can't do that symmetric pointing in order to get that setup to work out nicely. And the answer is that you can indeed get an Einstein-Maxwell ADS4, Einstein-Maxwell ADS5, and Einstein-Maxwell ADS3. But not ADS7. So the corresponding generalizations we will do is generalize the setup for the ADS-TFC correspondence for the ADS5, etc. For the ADS7 setup, we'll get a theory because black holes exist, but it's at best a cousin of the six-dimensional theory and that we're familiar with in that setup, and not actually the one that we know from the non-spinning case. So this is an example of the ansatz you can use, the Glucosylian ansatz you can use, this is the geometrical side, which truncates the theory to Einstein-Maxwell. So there's the Einstein-Maxwell piece, there's the cosmological constant, there's the Chern-Simons term, which will be switched off because we're looking at U1 charged black holes for the entire discussion. Question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask about the Chern-Simons.
Yeah, okay.
You do get that.
You do get a Chern-Simons term. There just supersymmetry considerations required to be there. And if you hadn't, then clearly something would have been wrong somewhere. So it's there, but it'll be off. Because we're just going to be looking at you. Okay. Okay. I will actually, it's maybe a good time to mention that once we start studying black hole solutions in this setup, all supersymmetries will have gone away. And of course, this fits with our intuition in the ADS-TFC correspondence because this is the R symmetry we're breaking, the six-symmetry algebra. And what we've done, we take the R symmetry, which is SO even, say, in this case, and we really take the diagonal U1 of the cosmos of algebra as a surviving R symmetry. And that at least means that we've broken everything down considerably. And just from looking at the black hole solutions, they have no supersymmetry left over. There are naked guys, which are singular, but don't come in from thermodynamical ensembles, as far as I know.
Okay, so the relevance of holography then is as follows. So in ADA holography then, the negative cosmological constant kind of guarantees that we're going to get some holographic theory. The nice thing is that it's actually a family series that we're already familiar with. So the relevance of brains is simply that we take the brains whose near horizon geometry we were studying for the usual ADS-CFT correspondence, and we set them rotating in the way I just mentioned. And then the field theory that everything is dual to is just that field theory. And so in field theory language, all we're saying is that we have this global current which lives on the world volume, and we're simply choosing a background global current to couple everything else in our field theory to. We're choosing this diagonal U1 I mentioned, for example, is equal to 4k. Before the SO6, we choose the diagonal U1 current and switch it on and couple our theory to it. And so that's really what we're studying when we look at the properties of these black holes that I'll mention in a moment. So that's the relevance of the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's just old friends with some of the global current switched on. No. It's just the global current which I'm allowing Yes. But I wouldn't call it a gauge field anymore. Right, because it's not a gauge symmetry. Excuse me? Right. Yeah. Which is something we do in field theory all the time. It just happens to be an R-symmetry current which we're switching on, but it could have been any global current. Okay, so the charged black hole solutions then come along as follows. So I'm going to rescale the action ever so slightly. I rescaled the solution ever so slightly to this form. So I've taken out some stuff in front of the gauge field to make that just a net square term without some positive cosmological constants in front. And there's gamma, lambda, and I'm for now keeping this in arbitrary dimensions. The solutions look like this. And so they're the obvious general horizon motion generalizations of the Schwarzschild solution I mentioned before. These were written down in various papers by Romans and London, I think, and possibly others. So you can read off the various parameters. There's the mass in terms of little m, there's the charge in terms of the little q which occurs in the metric, and this constant c I just have around. To simplify some of the expressions. So we go through then and we say the same thing. Condition for a non-singular horizon, we haven't said that yet. The condition for a non-singular horizon in R plus is something like this, which should remind you of the BPS condition if we were studying black holes in without cosmological constants be the same discussion, but the extremal solution is not supersymmetric in this case. The actual supersymmetric solution is actually a naked singularity, and for which you can't define a sensible temperature as we see in traditional techniques, and so they are naturally out of the thermodynamic discussion we have today, but there still may be some interesting role and naked singularities in this kind of discussion, but certainly not this one. So what I'll do for now, N will be the dimensionality of the field theory, and we'll focus on N plus 4 with many of our formulae, but pretty much everything I have to say the rest of the talk will generalize to all N greater than 2. So we'll really be looking at the equals 5 rising motion ADS solution. So we Euclideanized as before and define a period, and again we check that we have removed all the conical singularities, and here's the temperature beta, or inverse temperature beta, which I can write in terms of the charge or in terms of the potential, I should mention that the potential has defined, the asymptotic potential is defined up here is chosen such that the potential at infinity
is given by this thing pi, and then so I made a choice at the horizon r plus such that it's zero.
Yeah.
So you've obtained this charge by putting a rotation in the five dimensional here. So that means in terms of the 10-dimensional solution, if you do this analytic continuation, you're not going to get a real Euclidean vector, right? You're likely to get something complex.
If I do the which analytic continuation?
Well, this analytic continuation, too, because you really have a rotation. It looks like if you just look at the five-dimensional ADS part of the metric, it looks static. So you can analytically continue to treat it like a black hole. But the full 10-dimensional metric, I think, will be complex.
No, I don't think so.
You rotate the angular metric. Well, that's
right.
Q.
Right. Q has... Okay, I see what you're saying. I've done an appropriate... Euclideanization of the Maxwell piece to make that work.
So you analytically continue to
Right. Yeah.
Do you also have a factorized for the T component?
Excuse me?
Do you also have a factorized for the T, every T in it?
Yes, that's the Euclideanization. Sorry, I should have got some before. Didn't realize. Okay, fine. Okay, good. So I've written this in terms of both charge and in terms of the potential, because later on I will do two thermodynamic ensembles. I have a choice of fixing the potential or fixing the charge, and it would be appropriate to write the temperature in terms of fixed charge or fixed potential, depending upon which thermodynamic ensemble I choose to work in. So the action calculation then works as follows, and this is a caricature, unfortunately, because there are details. So I mention a number of crucial things. So first of all, so there's the familiar term, there's the term that Gibbons and Hawking and Horowitz, I think, motivated for getting the equations of motion, just the pure gravity part, to work. And if I were working at fixed charge, in order to fix the charge, fix the flux at infinity, I would add a term like this. And actually, I forgot to credit the folks who actually originally did this. I forgot who they are, but you can... York and Company, indeed, yeah. Okay, and so here we have M, which is, to do the calculation, you choose M as some compact region of space-time, DM as the boundary, and then, so I've defined here gamma, the induced metric on the boundary. And then, of course, this is all infinite, as we take M out to infinity, and so we need to regulate by subtracting off the contribution from some reference background. This is how the Gibbons-Hawking calculus works. It actually seems now that there are prescriptions available which perhaps make this careful consideration of the background not necessary, but that's another discussion. But this is the way we're going to do it. We subtract the contribution from an appropriate background which matches chosen appropriately to match at M, and then we subtract as we go out to infinity and get a finite answer. So, for example, throwing away the Maxwell pieces for now, it would turn out to be just a volume difference in the case of pure empty space solutions like in the Schwarzschild case, and it would just turn out to be a volume difference. And if you just go ahead and evaluate the volume difference, you would get it wrong unless you were careful to do what I said and match the geometries at the boundary to sufficient accuracy in expansion in 1 over r, where r is the radius of the ball upon which you do the calculation. So what you would do is match the period beta appropriately and then take the calculation. That'll give you a sensible answer. So that's a caricature of how you do it, but there's an analogous thing when there are other pieces floating around. Okay, so
ultimately, so that was how you would get the Schwarzschild result to come out, and with the full setup here for the charge case, for fixed potential we get the following result as fixed charge. So I can do the calculation holding the charge fixed or the potential fixed, as I said before, and here they are. And so, good. Okay, and omega 3 is the volume of the 3 sphere which surrounds the black hole. I think everything else is explained. L squared is universal, minus L squared. Okay, so what we then need to do is go ahead and do the thermodynamics, but I should make a crucial point here, which is that for the fixed potential case, we use as a background ADS plus some fixed potential at infinity, which is a perfectly good thing to use, as used in analogous computations in flat space by people in the audience. The fixed charge, however, ADS itself is not a charge, is not a solution of Einstein's, Einstein-Maxwell ADS, and there's not an appropriate background to use. And instead, one should use the extremal black hole itself as a background with that same charge. So this action then is zero for those guys, and this measures the action of the non-extremal guys above that at fixed charge. Okay, so now we're in good shape. We can actually go ahead and try and study the thermodynamics. So let me first of all go ahead and check that everything makes sense. So we should go ahead and take our temperature and compute our energies and charges and things. And so we go ahead and compute the energy perfectly defined, keeping the appropriate thing space. Now we have the extra pieces. That's a phi, not the S, I apologize. That indeed gives you the mass, and if you do that for the entropy, you indeed get a quarter of the horizon area, and for the charge, you indeed get the charge. And similarly, for the fixed charge ensemble, you can do the same calculation, except that you get the subtracted off, you get the difference between the background mass and the okay, so that seems consistent. So we can, emboldened by this, we can go ahead and actually study now what the family of phase transitions would be, if any. And so what I want to first do is take a step back and remind you that we got an interesting structure in our equations for the allowed temperatures in terms of the allowed temperatures for the charge, in terms of the charge of the potential. They're a lot more interesting with non-zero Q or non-zero phi than they were in the case of the pure Schwarzschild case, and more non-zero Q, I should say. And it's actually worthwhile going and plotting these folks and seeing what they look like. So what I have here is a plot of the inverse temperature. Let's look at the fixed potential ensemble for a moment. Let's look at the allowed temperatures as a function of the radius of the horizon, which is called R plus. And you can, this is just snapshots from the paper, so the battle below refers to choices made there. So what we have then is I've taken three snapshots. I've taken the case, the comparison zero potential, which would be the Schwarzschild case we discussed before, and there is that maximum beta, so there's a beta, this is beta versus alpha, and there's that maximum that I told you about defining that minimum temperature. And then here are some intermediate cases, for example, some intermediate value of the at some critical value of the potential, the shape of this curve goes over from being this shape like this, where it goes down to zero, to actually diverging at some particular value of the radius, which corresponds to the extremal value of the horizon. And so we have this characteristic different behavior for large potential versus small potential. Actually, for these two look the same, but really what's going on here is that if you look carefully, this gets close and then diverges very close. So if it's no, that's not true, I apologize. That's, I'm running ahead of myself. What I said just now was true. Scratch that last sentence. Okay, so this is going to mean something as we go a little bit further on. Let me point out now, for the fixed charge setup, this is what I was running ahead to you. We have, again, there's a comparison with the uncharged case, and what we have is for large charge, we have generically this behavior like this, monotonic is decreasing behavior like that, and there we see the zero temperature, so infinite beta case of the extremal hole. And we have for above the charge, the charge below a certain critical value, we have this interesting behavior where we get the temperature comes down for a while, beta comes down for a while, the curve comes down for a while, and then gets this bump like that. And you can see this bump eventually evolves to a shape very reminiscent of this as you turn the charge further and further down. And of course, as you get really low but not zero in the charge, it'll look a lot like this, and then there'll be a little spike just near the origin, and that goes away for absolutely zero charge because you don't have the corresponding extremely black hole divergence. So the reason I'm pointing this out is because at some temperature, at some temperature in this region, we have three possible black hole solutions. This is a generalization of what we saw in the uncharged case, where at some temperature we had two possible black hole solutions. So there's the large, that would have been the large masses and the small masses, large radii, small radii. And we learned from that previous case that this branch here is an unstable branch. The specific heat is essentially minus the slope of the curve. And you can actually observe that we have a similar branch here, this sloping piece here between there and there is actually an unstable, a thermally unstable branch, analogously. So there are two stable branches, which are called branch 1 and branch 3. Question.
This is a little off topic. There is something being answered with Gary's question earlier, and it's been right. Because generically, certainly the Western North Stream, if when I analyze it, continue to measure the time, I analyze the charge, I don't have.
I'm confused by that. I'm confused by that comment.
Imaginary electric field section.
Say that again.
I think you're probably working with imaginary electric fields in the swimming section. It's the right thing to do for the
Okay. I think
the reason that you don't have an extreme solution generally for swimming the charge is you have one minus.
I actually think that's what I said because I pointed to the S squared term and discussed continuing that. But that will translate into the electric field.
The impression I got.
That will translate to your electric field comment. Okay, well, I think someone in the audience said that and I said yes to speed up moving on. What I pointed to was actually the S squared term. Okay. Let's move on. So I will give you a blow up of that curve in a moment. So what we want to do is study then not just the evolution of the system as temperature goes by, but the varying values of the charge. We can see that qualitatively there's going to be some interesting structure. So this is what I want to get to. So let me do the case of the fixed potential ensemble, which is interesting but not as exciting as the fixed charge ensemble.
And the fixed potential ensemble, if we look at the free energies, well, the actions essentially the same thing up to the power of the the temperature factor of the temperature. We have the following. So what I've done is I've shown you, focus on the middle curve for a minute. I have a series of snapshots at varying potential, and I'm going from small potential to large potential. And so this is the case of zero. So this really is the Hawking Page situation. And this part, this branch here, which remains positive, is the branch corresponding to the small black holes, which, if you remember, were always unstable and always had positive action. And so there they are. And then there's this rapidly decreasing branch here is the large black hole. And so as a function of temperature, you can see then that the ADS is favored until critical temperature there, where all of a sudden the free energy of those black holes becomes rapidly negative and they dominate the ensemble. So this nice shape here is the Hawking Page situation. What we see for the fixed potential setup is that as we vary the potential, we have pretty much the same sort of structure at each value of the potential. What actually happens is that the critical temperature decreases as we increase the potential. So our phase diagram will at each fixed potential slice will look a lot like Hawking Page. And I'll show you the phase diagram in a minute. But then when you put them all together, you'll have an interesting critical line because the critical temperature is changing. There's a subtlety here, I should mention. So as we get this one sort of merges into the axis, and then this one is it's very, very large potential. Notice actually that the at zero temperature, there seems to be, you would intuitively expect it to go to zero, and it's actually a non-zero free energy there. And that, we believe, is an artifact of the fact that the Givens Hawking calculus doesn't take into account that at low temperatures, some of the physics could be dominated by the fact that extremal black holes can radiate away some of their charge. Near extremal black holes can radiate away some of their charge due to superradiant type effect. And what we think, well, this actually, this discrepancy here is a contribution from the extremal black holes. And we think essentially if you could do the calculation more honestly in this regime, you would actually see that this settles down going into zero. And so we don't actually think that this represents the stable situation at zero temperature. This extremal contribution will go away. Oh, just because I have really in this ensemble, I have the fixed potential, and really what I have is a gas of not just thermal quanta, but charged thermal quanta, which can be emitted and absorbed by the holes. And what I'm trying to say is that the effects due to superradiance are not taken into account in the type of Euclidean calculations that we've done here. And those will be very important. Those will be comparable to the usual emission absorption processes for Hawking testing. As we're in this regime. So that because we have a gas of charged particles floating around, the Kaluza-Klein charged particles, at fixed potential, there's a subtlety. But it's not anything deep.
You can't really fix the
potential. Well, yes, you can fix the potential, but the calculation will not be sensitive to the fact that it wants the extremal guy to stay as the background, whereas we want to compare to a gas of charged particles all over space, and it just the calculation knows about the calculation knows about the geometry of the fixed charge guy. Right. This won't be a problem in the fixed charge ensemble because we really are keeping the charge effect on an extremal black hole.
So there are things to be said. So here's the phase diagram for these guys. So the crucial thing then is that at every fixed potential slice, it really looks like Hawking page, but the transition temperature has varied, has gone down, and so the resulting phase diagram looks like this.
So what we have is ADS. So let's say it's a zero potential for a moment, and there's that diagram I had before, since I had red, but if you can translate, the light blue instead. And so there would be the Hawking page transition there to non-extremal black holes. And this happens at each fixed potential, the transition temperature just goes down. And so we have a line like that showing the transition to the two-dimensional plane. What I've done here is I have put a little blue line there to say that this really is ADS, that this would go back down to. The calculation gave you an extremal black hole right there at zero temperature, and we think that's not correct. The super radiance would take care of that.
So let's move on then to what in my opinion is slightly more interesting, which is, at least for the point of view of the title, which is the case of fixed charge. And I've gone and muddled myself at the moment, so talk amongst yourselves while I just quickly fix my muddle. I usually have a unfortunately, I usually have a slightly larger work surface to work with, so there I go blaming the equipment. Okay, so I can't seem to find it, but let me go ahead and here we go. Here it is. It was right where it should be. Okay, so here is the situation for the fixed charge case.
So remember, so here's a snapshot of what I was thinking about before, blown up. There's branch one black hole with some oxygen temperature, there's branch two black hole, and there's branch three. And you should already be going, hey, I remember that. But anyway, let's not run ahead of ourselves. And what's going on then is that branch one gives a contribution, has its free energy, which runs from zero down like that. Branch two joins it and goes up like that. And then branch three comes out and goes down like that. So what happens in the thermodynamics at some temperature, at some charge, is that I run along right from T equals zero. I go into the branch one non-extremal black hole behaviors, and I run along here for a while. But I get here, and I see that the guys with lowest free energy is no longer the branch one guys, but the branch three guys. So I go on to that branch. That gives me a discontinuity in the derivative of the free energy, but not a discontinuity in the free energy. It's first order phase transition as we want. And so that's what happens. And that's generically what happens for, I'll come back to this in a moment, that's generically what happens for all charge. Here they are. Here's a series of snapshots. And you can see then at zero charge, there's the Hawking page sort of profile, and then as you switch on the charge, you see that a little kink comes in from infinity, and there's the case I was discussing before. And then for large enough charge, what happens is that this little kink eventually shrinks away, and this just smoothly does that. And so we don't see a transition from the branch one guys to the branch three guys anymore. We just see them smoothly go into one another. And that's as a result of the fact that above that critical charge value that I mentioned before, the plots, these minima and maxima go away. You just get that. So it all fits quite nicely. But let's go back and look at this curve again. So what actually happens on this plot is that I'm moving down here. This is like the equation of state, and I'm moving down here in solution space, And then all of a sudden, the free energy, minimum free energy condition tells me that I should go here instead, and then continue moving down these guys. And of course, that should be familiar. What happens here is that I jump discontinuously from small black holes to large black holes.
Okay, so I give up a lot of
heat because the entropy, which is given by some power of the
radius, which is the area,
the entropy jumps. That should happen in the first order phase transition.
So I'm melting, or I'm solidifying, I'm vaporizing, or I'm condensing. And this is, of course,
if you were an undergraduate, you'd remember that this is just a lot like Van der Waals.
And it's exactly Van der Waals. Measure of fact, it's the phase diagram looks just like the liquid gas
system. Here is the phase diagram. I have zero temperature, zero charge. I have still the Hawking phase ADS for a while, and then transition to non-entropy black holes. But at arbitrary temperatures and charge, I have this beautiful phase diagram where I have non-extremal black holes here. If I cross the red line, I jump discontinuously with first order phase transition to the non-extremal black holes, which I call branch 3. But of course, above a certain critical charge, there are paths where I can continuously go from one to another. And of course, we know that when we have a gas, we're changing the we have a pressure temperature profile, here it is, of course what happens is that I have these transitions where the gas goes through the liquid discontinuously, but above a certain critical temperature, changing the pressure just makes me move continuously from liquid to a gas, so that's why the critical point occurs at the end of the critical line, and this is the coexistence phase, the coexistence curve. Which we could get, yes.
Could that happen dynamically? As in, like, go near the black hole, turn off some radiator, increase the temperature, and after a while, something.
Well, I've already been thinking about making heat engines out of black hole thing. A whole new way of making a refrigerator.
What then would be the
Oh, this line is just the coexistence line, the fact that at that particular temperature, the free energies of these large black holes are the same as the small black holes.
Well, but in
excuse me? Right. Yes. That's the same thing. Yes, because I can exist anywhere.
There's only one black hole. You've only got one system.
That's true, but just to extrapolate the language,
anywhere along this line, okay, I can that constitutes the mixed phase in the Van der Waals type language.
Yeah.
In the Van der Waals type language, yeah, okay, we can have fun and discuss what that means in terms of the black holes. But let me finish. Yeah, okay. So that's really nice, and
can I just ask one thing about this, so you have this free energy going down to some large negative thing,
yeah.
A large black hole on all this tape. Now, what is that? Why is it stop dropping down so? Is that going down to some finite gap?
No, it's just going.
It's very, very steep on this scale. In order to take the snapshot so you can see this, this is very, very steep. But on a smaller snapshot, it would be just sort of going happily. Yeah.
Okay. And then you may worry, but you know, how do I know those guys are so complicated? How do I know that something crazy doesn't happen down there? And then I go, catastrophe theory, of course, tells me that that this is generically what I should expect. So you stare at this for a while late at night in your office, and then you go, hey, I've seen these before. This is, of course, the swallowtail. And this is shape of what's called the swallowtail. And then this whole business here is really just a snapshot of what's called the cusp. So I've plotted the cusp for you. Catastrophe theory is a really fancy name for just sudden jumps in some state variables when you vary some control variables, and we call these phase transitions in physics. And so that's really what's going on.
So we have the black hole radius, inverse temperature, and the charge. And you can just basically watch that above some critical value of the charge, somewhere up there, I take a path and I just go along and I just continuously move from large to small black holes. And below some critical value of the charge, basically I get here, this folded part is folding back on itself of the unstable branch 2 guide. And so basically we just jump straight down, and the negative free energy condition tells us when that happened, if we were in the 19th. If we're in the late 19th century, that would have been called Maxwell's equal area law description, where the area on that side is equal to the area on that side, and then you're matching vapor pressures of the two systems. But for our case, it's just negative free energy. So that's how it works, and it's really nice. And this is the cusp catastrophe. And basically, catastrophe theory for a complex system which has a lot of variables and you can't solve all the differential equations, it just tells you with certain assumptions what kind of shapes you get that control the entire structure of the phase transitions. And for example, for two control parameters, there are seven elementary catastrophes, as they're called, and they basically actually have an ADE classification, which is somewhat amusing. And it's just singularity theory. So we've just seen one of them, but you may speculate about whether the others may come in. Actually, we now know that with further work that, yes, it is indeed, once you have this, and once you actually go ahead and just do the thermodynamics on this, you're just driven to that swallowtail curve for the free energy. It's very generic. And as a matter of fact, you can go through and do this sort of analysis by choosing various other parameters to be your equations of state, and then analyzing, doing stability analysis and that sort of setup, and getting interesting phase diagrams and what have you. I'm probably running over, so let me just conclude and say, gee whiz, look at that, cool. but no, given that I have a sober audience here, I will say. So we have then, we now understand the phase structure, we now know what all of this stuff means in terms of the field theory. We should of course check that for the large black holes which dominate at high temperature, that we do indeed get the field theory type behavior. Of course we can't say an awful lot about intermediate temperatures in the field theory comparison. What we can do, of course, intriguingly, at low temperature, the fixed charge ensemble, we actually said there's an extremal black hole there at zero temperature, and so of course that means that we have some non-trivial, non-zero entropy for the field theory in that fixed charge background at zero temperature. And it would be interesting in the spirit of what we were doing three years ago now, Stroman, Joe Baffa, etc., see whether one can compute that entropy is purely field theoretic. The thermodynamics is really nice and rich and gives us an extra leg on our phase diagram. And then we just see this marvelous pattern of equilibrium thermodynamics from classic thermodynamics texts, putting theory at it. And of course, if ADS has allowed that to happen, that extra family of black holes, which play the role of either liquid or gas, depending on how you think about it, wouldn't have come up if you didn't have negative cosmological constants. And that's really very nice, and in my opinion, that's a further demonstration that black holes and their quantum dynamics are not that different from anything else. And then you might wonder, as some of you already have, what does it mean having the cusp and the swallowtail appearing? Can we have more? Can we have all the other catastrophes coming up in this sort of situation? We might be able to, even though we might not be able to solve the complicated systems, we might be able to make some general statements about the kind of phase structures you get just using catastrophe theory, hence the name of the title, hence the name of the talk, and there'll be more to say by us or others later. So thanks for listening.
Yes, right.